Chats, the show where I, Josh Pickford, founder of Bear Metrics, hop on a call with my founder pals and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with Brad Smith, founder of Verb and CEO of Simplecast, among many other things. Brad started and been involved with so many things, it's hard to cover all of them. But in this episode, we talk about how he started a design agency out of the ashes of a web division inside a pager company, it was starting a social network, taking big bets with a massive company pivot, getting acquired, losing your company literally overnight, the future of podcasting, and a heck of a lot more. Hope you enjoy. Side note, there is a little bit of swearing in this episode. Now, on with the show. Hey, Brad, thanks for hopping on a call.
It is great to be here, Josh. Thanks for asking right when I took a drink of water.
hopefully, any question I ask, you could, you know, preface it with a sip of water.
Yeah, no, I plan on it. Loud gulps good. And then a response. Yes. That's the theme.
Clear your throat a lot, too. That'd be great.
Perfect.
Yeah. So to kind of get things started, I would love to hear you just like as a kid, I guess. So you're in New York now, but like where'd you grow up?
Born and raised in the rolling cornfields of Missouri.
Missouri.
Yeah, the show me state, which I still do not know necessarily what that means. It's the home of Branson, Missouri.
Yes.
The country music capital of the world.
And where everyone's grandparents have been.
100%.
Yeah. So what was that like? I mean, growing up, you know, was it small town Missouri or...
No, it was very, very small town Missouri. I think my high school graduating class was around 60 people. I mean, going to St. Louis was, holy God, what is this metropolis?
Right.
So it's weird always because people are like, you know, what was it like growing up in a small town? And I don't know because you had nothing to compare and contrast it against.
Sure.
So your small town was everything you knew.
Right.
Yeah. And I was a big outdoorsy kid too, so I don't know where that went in my life to where now I'm just attached to a glowing screen all the time, but it used to be very outdoorsy. So living in rural Missouri and kind of the middle of nowhere was great for outdoorsy things.
Were you into like Boy Scouts or anything like that?
Yes.
That's cool. So like camping, the whole works.
The whole works. Yeah,
that's good stuff. So I guess, I mean, how did you make that transition? I mean, as a kid, were you into technology at all, or was it pure 100% outdoors?
Oh, no. Well, it all probably started. We didn't even have a computer in the house until we had like a 386. I think I was a junior, maybe even a senior in high school. But it all really started probably my freshman year in high school because I joined, I always loved art and drawing and things like that throughout, you know, childhood. But it was probably my freshman year of high school when we bought a camcorder for the house and, you know, the big one that sat on your shoulder and took the full size VHS tapes.
VHS.
Like there was no like, let's put a small tape in this. No, we put a tape that's the size of, you know, Back to the Future. 1985 in this. So
part of me thinks that they did that because it just made it look so much cooler to have this massive thing sitting on your shoulder than
100%. 100%. And I was like, how can I create all these things with this camcorder? So I don't even think that anybody else got to use it. I was strapping it to my bike, which mom never learned about.
Jeez.
Thank God. I would put it on a skateboard and I just had a lot of fun with it. And shortly thereafter I joined Yearbook, and being a tiny little school with very little budget, all we had was the Apple IIe, meaning the yearbook design was still done with wax pencils and drawing crop lines on photos and, you know, glue sticking them to a press sheet, which you would then send off to the printer. But we had one Apple IIe, and that's where all the content was typed in. So that was really my first foray into a computing device. And again, I think I probably was a junior in high school, and we got a Packard Bell 386. It was a Canon. I take that back. Canon used to make computers, and that really changed everything for me.
What do you think it was about having a computer that really sort of like struck a chord for you? I mean, like using that as a sort of input device over, say, you know, the traditional sort of graphic design.
Well, I mean, you think about, you know, if you wanted to be a musician or something, which I was in band and I was terrible at and dropped out. But like every type of creating required some investment into it. Like if I want to be a great saxophonist, I need to own a saxophone and do all this. And the computer for me was this whole of like infinite possibilities. Like I can record audio on it and do something with audio. I can draw a picture on it and do something with that picture. So to me, it kind of felt like this device sitting in front of you that really gave you the ability to do anything you wanted. Granted, it was the early days of computing and the pre-days of the internet. But you know, just the ability to, you know, there was rudimentary like recording tools and you could go in and add soundtracks and add a beat and add a trumpet to something. To these audio tracks. So it was really just this tool of kind of unlimited possibilities. That sounds really cheesy, but that's kind of how I looked at it.
Well, no, that makes sense. So you're finishing up, I mean, you know, freshman, junior year of high school, kind of starting to get into computers. How does that parlay into, did you go to school after?
I did. I went for about a semester and got kicked out. So flunked out, didn't get kicked out. I really got into computer hardware at that point. And I guess you could call it my sad first company, but I was doing like custom build computers for, you know, people in the dorm. Sure. And I had this catalog printed out and you could pick from this motherboard and this case. And I didn't make anything on it. I basically just charged whatever my costs were going to be, but it was a lot of fun. And in that process, I started poking around with Tripod, God rest its soul, and yes, kind of learning how to lay out items for the web. And, you know, using AOL to dial into internet access and not realizing that some numbers are long distance and getting a $500 phone bill. You know, the early days of the internet there.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
So what do you think it was about college that didn't interest you? I mean, or at least was it more so that you found the business side or the idea of like starting your own thing interested you more?
Well, so one thing is I'm a terrible student. I'm a great student. Like I was a very high GPA all through high school, but I hate tests. Yeah. I do not test well at all. I do not this let's put you under pressure and you have to now distill everything you've learned into this one tiny little bit. Sure. I don't do well at that. I never did. Like the SATs, the ACTs, it was more anxiety than anything. And there was something about buying my first like HTML book and staying up late at night and reading that and, you know, Adobe PageMill, downloading that and learning like page layouts and, you know, pre-Photoshop days. Sure. There was something very... And you got to realize like this was 95, 96, 97. Like this wasn't being taught in college. You weren't taking classes to learn like web design. And I quickly realized that, you know, I was enjoying my late night educational endeavors more than I was school. And it wasn't this thing that I planned on doing. It's just, I would stay up all night and miss my morning classes and started, you know, getting clients and started doing websites for them at this point and creating things.
Yep. Yeah. What, did your family care one way or the other about the college stuff? I mean, like, was that a hard decision to kind of drop out of college or?
I'm sure it was. My dad had just died, prior to this. So I almost feel it was kind of like the least biggest possible blow to a family at this time. But, it wasn't. And, you know, I guess I have my mom a lot to thank for that because it could have been a, no, you need to go back to school. But I also didn't want to have school loans and I didn't want to be in debt like everybody else was already starting to at this point. So, you know, quickly after I left Missouri State University after a year or after a semester, I realized that I had to make money somehow and playing around building websites and, you know, doing custom built computers wasn't going to work. So I got a job basically doing, sales and repair at a computer shop, in Springfield, Missouri, where I lived at this point, where Missouri State University was located. And I ended up spending a year and a half there, learned a lot, but in the process actually got to work on the company's branding design website. So that was kind of like my first big dive into it. And there was no turning back after that.
Do you feel like you had, even from that point, a knack for design, or did you have to work hard to make that stuff?
I don't think I have a knack for anything. I feel a lot of it is finding something that makes you really happy and you're excited about, and you want to get out of bed every day and go, I don't 100% know how to do this, but I'm going to figure it out, and I'm going to figure out the right way to do it, and I'm going to do it. I mean, there's a whole lot of just, you know, kind of being a founder and running companies, as you know, that is that, because people all the time, they'll ask, you know, well, what's involved in starting your business? It's like, well, you really just have to start.
There is no manual. So you kind of start picking up like, hey, I enjoy this, the whole process of building websites and designing things and all that. So, I mean, you mentioned you were at the sales and repair place for what, a year and a half?
About a year and
so
a half. What did you do after that? In 99, so this was again Springfield, Missouri still. And there was a pager shop. This was pre-cell phone. There was a pager shop in town that had launched a web division. They were doing like websites and hosting and dial-up internet. So they were kind of just this communication hub. And I went and applied there for the web design department, and do not know why, but they gave me a job. And I think for the first 2 months, I literally designed banner ads for an ad network that they had. 468 by 60, what's the dimension? But literally for the first 2 or 3 months I was there, all I did was design banner ads and learn how to make GIFs in the banner ads. And
right.
So that was it. And after about 6 months there, helping the manager of the department really grow the team, hire people, she left for an opportunity elsewhere. And the owner of this company came to me and said, hey, would you like to manage this department? So I ran it for the next year and a half. It was in that time that I met and brought Ryan Sims onto the team.
Wow. Uh-huh.
This was 2000. And 2001 hit, 9/11, cell phones, a lot of things were happening with dial-up and ISDN coming along. So this company was probably not evolving as quick as it could. And the one department that they decided to axe was the web design department. Despite we had brought in a lot of hosting customers and we were getting a lot of, you know, bigger recognition for the work that we were doing, because despite being a web design division of a pager company, it was really good. And we got a 2-week notice and they're like, we've got to shutter this department. It's our biggest, employee expense, because we were probably a team of, I would say 10 or 11 at this point. So probably larger than any other part of the company. And I went to the owner of the company, who I'd got to know pretty well, and I said, look, like, I've put 2 years of my life into hiring people that I think are good designers and learning a lot. And keep in mind, I knew nothing at this point. I thought I knew everything.
Sure.
But I was like, is there any way that I can just take over kind of this hosting and design portion and kind of take the clients? And we worked out a deal for a dollar. So I got to take over all the current client base. And it was on that day in 2001 when I took Ryan Sims and a few other people from the team, and we launched Nubix.
That's great. That's a good transition. Because that's sort of when I think, first kind of was introduced, and probably most people, to like you and all the work that kind of came out of that. Had you hoped at some point to start your own sort of, I don't know, would you consider Nubix to be like an agency or?
Yeah, I mean, like it was an agency. We did everything. Okay. I mean, over the 6 years of Nubix, we did, you know, websites, we did print ads. We even made a couple television commercials. So we were very much a design focused agency, but I mean, we built early CMS for the web in 2001 and right. We branded it and had customers using it. So I didn't really know that I wanted to start a company until I got to to the company prior and started, you know, hiring a team member. And I realized this joy of like what it is to actually build a team instead of just building a website. Right. Like everybody I talked to when I wanted to spin out from this company where we were at and start Nubix, I mean, we were literally just a few months after 9/11. Everything was, everything was just in a weird limbo in the United States and probably the world at that point. So we had just had the dot-com bubble, whatever. So it was a weird time to go out and start something. And I had a house at this point. Because it's Southern Missouri, and you can own houses for your house payments, like $300 a month. It's cheaper to buy a house than it is to rent an apartment. And I went out and I took a loan against my mortgage, and that is basically the money that we invested into building Nubix for the first six to nine months.
Yeah. So you've got lots of clients. The thing that. Or the one that I think probably transitioned you guys the most, which correct me if I'm wrong here, you guys designed Pure Volume, right?
Not really. I mean, yes, no. But so the one thing that put Nubix on the map was, do you remember they're still around, the agency Too Advanced?
Yes.
Okay, so they were like the shit. In 2003. Like they did the most elaborate, beautiful Flash websites.
Gaudy, but like awesome.
Yeah, just like how does this happen on the internet? Because we had never seen anything like that in a web browser.
Right.
And so it was the big thing. But you know, they quickly grew as an agency and were only doing, you know, six-figure plus projects. And it was a Monday morning in 2003, and we were all sitting outside on this balcony at our office having coffee, and the phone rang, and I ran inside and grabbed it, and it was the head of biz dev for Too Advanced. And they're like, we've been watching you guys. We like your design. Can we have you fly out here to Los Angeles and, you know, talk about maybe taking some of the smaller projects off our plate that we don't necessarily want to do? And that literally overnight changed our company because we started getting bigger brands. You know, Simi and I had one thing early on that we knew that we were only getting paid $2,000-$4,000 for a website. But early on, we said, if it's a $4,000 project, we're going to put $8,000 worth of work into it. Like, there's no way we're ever going to take this to a new place if we only put in the work that we're being paid for. And it paid off, and it introduced the Too Advanced thing. And then we started doing bigger projects, and it was at South by Southwest in 2005 when we met the two founders of Pure Volume. And they were a fan of what we had done at Nubix and a fan of Ryan's design. And long story short, we ended up merging the two companies together. I shuttered the client portion of Nubix and offered any of the team members at Nubix the ability to move to Boston. And we shifted Nubix to Boston and merged it together and designed out and built Pure Volume.
So, I mean, what was it about Pure Volume that made you want to stop doing the agency stuff?
Two things, one product, which is the sweet and the sour of anybody in the industry of like product and client. You're like, oh, clients are the worst. Well, I can tell you some stories too. And you could too, Josh, that some days product is the worst. Mm-hmm. It's always the grass is always greener on the other side. So that was one element. But primarily, like Simi and I, we and Keegan and the other team members we had brought in, like despite we were a client agency, we were always very excited about building our own stuff internally. I mean, we built a dating app in 2002 and ran TV commercials for it. We built our own CMS, and it was all really probably shitty. And, but there was this always desire to build something of our own instead of building for clients. And that was the biggest draw to take a company that I'd ran for 6 years and literally shutter it and, you know, start working on a product was the draw of waking up every day and solving one problem. And then when you solve that, you figure out how to solve the next problem. You make it better and better and better. And that was the beginning of product for me.
What do you feel like you learned, or maybe by working on this one product kind of in a way that you had not up to that point, what, you know, you obviously go into that with some expectations about sort of the grass is always greener. Like, this will be amazing to work on the same product and make it, you know, just the greatest thing ever because we can focus all our time on it. What was your takeaway? I would, let's say the first like 6 months there that just kind of like shut down some of those.
Well, so that didn't really exist for the first 6 months because it was the honeymoon period. And it was this, oh my God, like this is incredible. Like, we are pouring blood, sweat, and tears into something that is for us. It's also probably where Ryan and I and some other members of the team really introduced ourselves into really bad work habits, because we enjoyed what we were doing so much that there was nights of sleeping at the office and working till 11 o'clock. And, you know, when you're early mid 20s, you can kill yourself like that. But so that didn't set in for quite a while. And I think that's just to this day why I still love products more than anything.
So what was after Pure Volume? I mean, you guys did that for a couple of years or something?
Pure Volume, actually, I only worked on the Pure Volume product with Simi for about a year. And then Pure Volume was, because you got to think, like, our only competitor out there at this time was MySpace. And we had a platform generating money, unlike MySpace, meaning you paid for placement on the homepage of Pure Volume. Bands paid for promotion within the network. So we were a social network for listeners and, you know, musicians, but the listeners had a free experience. The musicians had a free experience as well, unless they wanted to pay to kind of get their band out there. So Pure Volume did fantastic early on in that, not just the page views and the ads that we ran on it, but we had an early paid platform. And that began doing so well that that's where Verb came along. The whole idea that MySpace was, you know, truly the only real social network around at this point. Social networking was still brand new, and it looked terrible. And the only way to like make your MySpace profile look a little bit better was to hack together some CSS and, you know, throw it into the about section of your bio on MySpace. So the whole early vision for Verb is social networking can be beautiful. Social networking can be customizable. And, you know, that's great and good and all, but to flash forward a little bit, you know, 2 years down the road into Verb, the social network, you know, Tumblr had come out and taken a large amount of investment, and social networking quickly picked up a lot of steam, and it did not matter that Verb was hands down the easiest to use, best looking social network on the internet at that point. But we learned a very true fact that unless people have their community and their people on a platform, it doesn't truly matter how good it looks, how it works. If the people aren't there, nobody else is going to use it. And that's really what caused us to shift the vision of Verb, because what we started doing was looking at how people are using Verb. And what we had done was built a ton of social features, which nobody was using. But they were using our profile customization tools and our custom domain feature to basically build one-page websites. We made it so easy to import Flickr photos and this was pre-Vimeo, but whatever video service was popular at the time. Like, we made it easy to kind of aggregate all of your social content into this one very potentially good-looking page if you chose a nice theme and you customized it nice. So that's really what drove us to pivoting the company and literally keeping the name the same and emailing hundreds of thousands of users on the social platform and be like, guys, what we're doing isn't working. It's not working for us. And if it's not working for us, it's not going to even be around that much longer. So what we did is we took what we saw customers truly using our platform for, and we said, let's take that one element and let's turn that into a company. And that is where we shifted and the P word pivoted into Verb, the website builder that still exists today.
So what was that like for you as the person who had created this thing initially as a social network to have to basically pivot it, right?
Yeah.
To this separate thing. I mean, like, was that tough for you?
It was, because I mean, in the pivot, I mean, looking back, you can be like, what we did was the best call and, you know, it worked. But really what that meant was admitting failure. Like, we lost. We went out there as a small, scrappy team of five people working on Verb and thought we could take on a MySpace and then a Facebook and then a Tumblr. There's so many mistakes we made early on that if I had done things differently, I think the outcome could have been different. But also at the end of the day, like, I think everyone on the team, Ryan, Steven, we were kind of over the let's wake up every day and fight to have a social network.
Right.
Because there was so many competitors out there and the space was moving so quickly that it really was like, let's focus on a product that people need versus something that we're trying to add value just so they'll come and use.
Did the whole sort of website builder idea excite you, or is it just more it excited you that you could have something that people wanted?
It did both, because if we go back to the Nubix days, and like, I will find you screenshots and send this to you. In 2001, Simi and I built a website builder called Templux. And we actually, it was like $2 a month, and we had customers that ran on it. And so it was kind of this idea that we wanted to template the website development process. So for us, kind of shifting back into a website builder, which we never had planned on doing, was kind of a neat process, because that part of our life truly came back around.
What year was it that you made that transition from social network to website
builder?
Well,
when we had the big just internal, like, we're going to run out of money, we're not making enough ad dollars, we've got to get out of social networking, that was 2009. And then it was early 2010 that we kind of pulled the wraps off and launched the new product.
You mentioned going to run out of money. How had you guys tried to monetize the social networking side?
The social networking side was 100% monetized through ad dollars.
Ad revenue, okay.
Yeah, and we had talked about other options, and it still was probably too early for the web, but, you know, we had talked about a pro level tier, or maybe charging brands or charging bands, people that could use it to help grow their brand. But again, you know, there was... I was still learning to be a not terrible business person throughout this entire process. So I am who I am today because of the ability that I got to make a lot of those mistakes and make a lot of bad calls. And, you know, it cost us, so to speak, a company because of that, but something new was born out of that.
Yep.
So we were only ad revenue based, and we had taken a very small seed round from Media Temple. The hosting company had just launched Media Temple Ventures, which Damien, the CEO, it was phenomenal. It was just this idea that Media Temple, this hosting technology company, had this new arm, and this arm was just to do small seed investments in different, you know, tech startups.
So Media Temple, I mean, had you had any kind of relationship with Media Temple before that? They were huge into the sponsoring design stuff.
Yeah, so we used Media Temple as our host back in the Nubix days. So we were very, very, very familiar with Media Temple as a product. And the way I originally kind of got to know their head of biz dev and the CEO at that time was when we were trying to save Verb, the social network, we did this redesign and added a bunch of features in, which didn't really add new features. It just made what we already had work a little bit better. And to kind of just blow the doors off that, we started reaching out to people that would want to sponsor a South by party for our big relaunch. And that was where we started building a relationship with Media Temple around kind of Verb, the social network.
So you guys get the transition to website builder launched. What was the reaction for that? I mean, was it like, you're on some level starting from scratch?
Oh, 100% starting from scratch. Yeah. And I mean, did we have a lot of people using our social network to build a one-page landing site? We did, but that was free. That was hands down, will always be one of the most defining, like, fearful, exciting days of my adult life and career was, on the day that we launched the new platform, we turned off the old Verb. That meant all the money we were making from ad revenue was now gone.
Instantly stopped.
We turned off a faucet and then said, Now we wait to see if this other faucet gets turned on. And we had to wait a bit because, you know, Verb had a 10-day free trial.
Right.
And that first day I was scared because it was truly like, there's no middle ground. This is either going to work or we are going to fail miserably and have to shutter this company at some point. And it worked. I could go in for 2 hours about, you know, the things that we did to kind of help it along, but, you know, really positioning ourselves as a platform for the creator and giving them the tools that they needed as a photographer, a filmmaker, a musician to build a website with just the tools they need and nothing more, worked. And, you know, we had on our first day, we had 2 people add a credit card. And keep in mind, there was a whole 10-day free trial. And so that was so much more than we ever expected. And I still have a screenshot of the first two paid activations that we had.
That's fantastic. So what, I mean, how did you from the start make the decision to not have, you know, it's super typical to have this, well, we have a free plan and then you try to convince people to upgrade. But I mean, from the start, Verb was, you know, you could have a trial, but you're going to pay for the thing if you're going to keep using it.
Yes. Yes. A lot of that was not out of, again, you know, learning a lot about being a noobish business person, but a lot of it wasn't out of planning. It was out of sheer necessity, meaning sure. If we're going to build this tool and release it to the world, you know, it needs to be a tool that has value and it needs to be paid for. And, you know, because at this point, About.me had just launched their one-page landing sites and they were free. So luckily we got out of the whole, like, build a one-page website and got into the more robust Verb at that point, because About.me was a good, it shined a nice light on Verb, meaning, sure, you can come over here and this is a great free service and build a one-page website. But when you're ready to really build a website, something that adds value to your brand, yourself, your band, whatever, then, you know, that's where Verb comes in. So it really allowed us to use our pricing model as it's not free because it's really good.
Yeah, yeah. So you're doing Verb for as the website builder for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And then when did talks of Media Temple acquiring come up?
Well, that actually happened shortly after the website builder started to be successful. I was out in Los Angeles meeting with the board of directors, and we were having some really, really solid growth. And that's where the opportunity came up to Media Temple basically said, like, hey, we're a hosting company. And now this thing that we invested in 3 years ago is now a website builder. Like, how could this work out any better?
Right.
We need to pour gas on this and really get it going, because you got to realize at this point, Verb was still 5 people. We were only growing as our revenue grew, which means to hire a new person, you're waiting 6-8 months and then bringing in a new hire. And then you're back to, you know, $0 of profit every month.
Yep.
And that's where Damien and everybody else and John, the CFO at Media Temple, were like, let's just make Verb part of Media Temple. Let's acquire 51% of it. Let's like bring it in. And Verb will continue to be autonomous, but we will be your parent company and we will open the tap of money. And that's when Verb went from 5 people to 16 within probably 9 months.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, there was a lot of things in hindsight that made me think like, well, that was a bad decision. But honestly, it wasn't, because Verb would not still be around today and it would still not be a platform with customers using it had we not done that deal with Media Temple. Was I the wisest business person at that time? And did I have a lawyer and really look into, you know, in what was it, 9 years ago now? Did I really look into, you know, what I'm giving up and what my ownership and my stocks and shares were? I didn't. But John and Damien and the rest of the crew at Media Temple, like, it was truly a perfect scenario. I had my company, I was growing it, we were autonomous. I lived in New York, I ran a remote team. Media Temple's in LA. It was kind of a perfect scenario for multiple years.
Were there any correlations or like similar feelings to, you know, you mentioned when you basically shut down Nubix to join Pure Volume. I mean, was this similar in at all where you're like, you've got Verb, but now you're basically becoming a part of Media Temple? Like, was that sort of a grass is greener kind of thing, or was it just like, this is the natural evolution of this?
Nubix was a much more raw, personal. The whole idea of merging Nubix with the company that made Pure Volume, like, I said no at first. Like, it was a very, it was difficult for me because that company was my baby and Simi's baby. Right. Like, it is something that we poured 80 hours a week into for multiple years, and it was our own. And to just say like, oh, we're not going to do this anymore, and now we're going to bring more, you know, business partners in, it was very personal, and it took a while for me to decide to do that. Verb was a little bit different because we had already been through the shit of The Social Network and kind of getting punched in the gut and then recovering and turning that around. It was more of, I began to realize that I can't be like, we're going to go at our own and we're going to grow this thing under our own power of five people and whatever revenue I make. Like, the realization of, if we truly want to grow, we need capital and we need resources. So it was less personal and more about, finally, as a business person, having the realization that if we truly want to push through this and take this somewhere else, we can't rely on our own internal resources.
What was the landscape like at the time? Like, obviously, there's a ton of these sort of website builder things in existence now, but I mean,
right,
you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, what were there a lot then?
Yeah, or? I mean, we started building this in 2009, so it was almost 9 years ago, and Squarespace had just launched, but, you know, they were not a design-friendly platform. Squarespace was very developer-focused. It was not easy to use. It was powerful, but it wasn't geared toward the everyday user with a big focus on design. And I think that is why Verb did catch traction and take off when it did, because there was only a few. I mean, this was the early days of Wix. GoDaddy had a website builder at this point, and they all looked terrible. And we were the only platform that had a high standard for design. We did not have the best, most powerful tools as all the other website builders. We didn't. We were pretty cut and dry, and that's what made the platform so simple and easy to use. But the final outcome, when you published your website, it for certain looked better than anything you would have built with any of our competitors.
Yeah. So you're at Media Temple for a couple of years. Were you still there when GoDaddy came around to acquire Media Temple?
Yes. So that was kind of the end of the everything is perfect time frame.
What year was that?
Well, the possibility of GoDaddy acquiring Media Temple arose in early 2013. Okay. And this was the point at which Verb was, we had taken the Media Temple investment. We were growing quickly. You know, we had close to 20,000 customers at this point. The platform was taking off. The brand recognition was happening. Like, we found our groove, and we had a marketing budget, and we were hiring people, and it was perfect. But, you know, because a majority of Verb was owned by Media Temple, that basically when GoDaddy came along and said, we love Media Temple, we would like to purchase this, Verb was automatically included in that sale. Which was a very, very hard thing for me, because just like with Nubix, I had poured 6, 7 years of my life into something to then be like, okay, so this isn't going to be mine anymore. Decisions that I now make, I now put so much more thought into with investment and, you know, business partners and things like that, of really thinking out, this might be a great scenario now, but how is this going to play out for me personally, how is this going to play out for my team members and my employees 3, 4, 5 years down the road? And that was something early on with Verb, just I maybe didn't have the foresight for, but also Verb wouldn't have gotten to the point that it did without Media Temple and their resources and their support and their cash. So the GoDaddy deal ended up going down in October of 2013, and that's when GoDaddy purchased Media Temple. Prior to this, I had gone out and raised some funds from outside parties, as well as multiple executives of Media Temple, to basically buy Verb out of Media Temple before GoDaddy bought it. And GoDaddy was totally on board with this. So we had the funds raised. We were in the final week of negotiation. And, you know, for lack of not being able to say some things, and to make a long story, you know, as short as possible, some things with the agreement and terms changed in the early weeks of, you know, October, November. And the investors that I brought together basically said, we can't agree to these terms and we can't be a part of this. So I had that very tough realization is, okay, I either start from scratch and I go out and try to find more investors to help me buy this back. Or I just give up and, you know, go run my company now working for GoDaddy. And I decided that neither of those was the ideal option for me. So it was, I think it was tough because I literally had my baby pulled from my hands. And, you know, everything is great. I still have a wonderful relationship with Media Temple, and two of the founders of Media Temple are actually investors in my new company. Like, everything is great and wonderful there, but it really kicked me in the stomach and it messed me up for probably a good 6 to 9 months afterwards, because it was that part of my career where I realized so much that I was my work and my work was me. And then when you lose that overnight, you know, what are you?
Right. I mean, like that, you know, you hear of people, especially people who are like raising money to have investors back out. But I mean, that usually is on in the early days of the company, a lot of times before a company even really gets started. But for you, I mean, you've been working on it for many years when this thing all of a sudden basically just disappears for you.
Right, right. And it's really the whole buyback deal was a great deal, and then all of a sudden it wasn't.
Yeah.
And it was tough because I could have probably stuck in there and found out a way to still get it back. But at this point, I just personally was very beat up, emotionally very beat up. And I truly feel like I had just lost. So part of me gave up a little bit. I'm not going to lie about that. Like, it had been a long road and I had fought for this company multiple times, you know, getting it out of the social networking days and getting it into the website builder days. Like, it was always a roller coaster, and it was, and then just as we kind of hit that peak of the roller coaster and you're excited for the downturn, then that downturn was actually not a good downturn.
Right.
And so at the end of December in 2013, that's where I resigned from Verb.
Gotcha. What was it like for, I mean, obviously you guys have a team that's some people who have been there from the start, you know, for them to have to make this transition, was it just you that left or did multiple people leave?
Initially it was just myself, but it was shortly thereafter that multiple people left. I think just the whole corporate environment of going from a startup of, you know, 15 plus people where we call the shots, we make the rules to, you know,
and you were running with some autonomy.
Yeah, 100%. Completely autonomous. I mean, as long as we were making money and revenue was up and churn was down, like, we were an autonomous company. And so eventually a majority of the team ended up leaving over the next 18 months. And there was a lot of reasons for that, some which, you know, were personal to them and their experiences within Media Temple after I left. But, you know, also it's very drastic to go from, you know, working together with a group of people. Some of these people I'd worked with for 8-9 years at this point to,
right,
you know, literally be spending more time together every day than what they spent with partners and children to not having that anymore. And, you know, it changes the dynamic of a company when the boss is no longer the boss and there's somebody else in their shoes.
So, I mean, how do you even figure out what to do next after you've done this thing for almost 10 years and then it's, I mean, overnight gets pulled from you? What, how do you even navigate?
Probably about a dozen ways better than what I did to navigate it. I did, like, I've always just been a very anxious individual, my entire life. But those 6 months after Verb, I probably had the most treacherous, I had my first panic attack within that. it was this this whole like, what do I do now? Because everything prior, Josh, had been like, you know, pager company web design turned into Nubix, Nubix turned into Pure Volume turned into Verb Part 1, then turned into Verb Part 2. And everything had always parlayed into the next opportunity. And I, for the first time ever in my, you know, career, was like, there is no next step. It is the reset button has been pressed. And the only way now to really create something is to create something again out of nothing. And I was, you know, I had been beaten up and I was not in the best state as a human being after the whole Verb thing. And I wasn't ready to start anything. And I didn't at that point even know what I would start.
Yeah. So for that 6 months or so, I mean, did you just sort of like kind of just go travel or just stare at a screen and hope something came to you?
A little of both. I almost stressed myself out too much because I was like, I'm going to write and publish 2 blog posts every week. I'm going to do all this. I did retreat. I have a friend who lives in Hawaii and I went and spent about 5 weeks out there and, just kind of vanished from the internet. And, that was very good. But again, you know, running away from something never truly solves a problem. You feel better when you get back, but then you quickly realize, oh shit, that problem's still there. Right. So yeah. And I still returned not knowing necessarily what I wanted to do or focus on. And that's kind of when I met, Ryan and Tina, that had the Great Discontent. And I needed to put some passion into something and I didn't have any ideas on what I wanted to create yet. And I also knew that I probably wasn't in the best state to start something new. And so that's where I really teamed up with them and became a partner in the Great Discontent to really help them turn that kind of just brand into a company.
So what kind of, you know, so the Great Discontent publishes all these like long form interviews and like just lots of, I would say just great editorial sort of content or all, covering lots of stuff in like around people who make stuff, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that a fair sort of summary, I guess?
Yeah, no. It's great. I mean, it's publication, print, digital, podcast, live events, but the whole idea of it is it tells the stories of what it means to be a artist or a creative. Not just the fluffy, like, ooh, these are great quotes that I can use to live by. Like, it tells stories of risk and failure. And that's one of the biggest reasons why I wanted to be involved with it then, because it personally connected very much with me, you know, in the trials and tribulations of being a founder and a failed founder, that, you know, after Verb, it meant a lot to me.
What, I mean, the idea of sort of being a publisher or someone who's creating content, I mean, you know, previously, would you have considered yourself like interested in publishing? Or I know back in Nubix days, you guys had the Big Noob, which was, I would say, like a relatively popular blog, at least in design space. Had you always had some kind of interest there, or was it just more like the subject matter that interested you?
It definitely had some keen interest in that space, though most of that interest lied in audio, video, and audio, visual, and digital. Print was something that I was completely unprepared for, knew nothing about, and had to spend a lot of time learning. So definitely the idea of publishing content, because that's really where the next 2 years of my life were born out of, was Verb was a tool to let creators put their content onto the web. We focused on the creatives. And like I said, that was musicians, filmmakers, photographers. So creative individuals, we wanted to give them tools to put their content out there on the internet. And then after Verb, and I was really driven by the content itself and less about the technical software side of it. And I even vowed to myself that I would never go back into the internet world of SaaS and products. Yeah. But I should have never told myself that because it's the best thing that I've ever done. But, so yeah, I was really, really driven by publishing quality content, and creating quality content. And then it was out of kind of the Great Discontent that Wayward Wild was born. And Wayward Wild, you know, was pretty much an incubator for content brands, and not just print, but digital or audio, and really just how can we take a creator that really needs to be out in the world, and how can we help turn their idea and maybe their small digital publication into a business? And that's what Wayward Wild was about for a year and a half.
So Wayward Wild, is that ultimately like what led you to Simplecast?
100%. Yeah. Wayward Wild led me to Simplecast, in so many ways. Some I had planned, others I hadn't. You know, one thing that I realized quickly into Wayward was we didn't need to just focus on helping creators grow their business with their content, but we needed to build the tools. And that's where I planned on launching a product studio within Wayward. And the first product that was in that studio was Simplecast.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not that you guys approached Simplecast after the fact to acquire it. It was started within?
No, it wasn't. Josh Long and some other individuals, like, it started Simplecast as an early platform in, I think, 2013, 2014. And I had known Josh for quite a while. And knowing that I wanted to do something, I could talk for 20 minutes about why I wanted to do something in the audio space, but to really dumb it down is I was introduced to podcasting again in the Wayward Wild incubator. And I realized, holy God, like podcasting is still running on the exact same janky infrastructure and RSS technology as it was the last time I had looked at a podcast, which was in 2005 or 2006. Right. So I immediately knew, like, there is a problem here and I want to fix it. Josh had built an early platform for hosting and analytics in the podcasting space that, you know, was kind of something that he was running solo. He had brought in a few contractors with, and I really went to him and I was like, I have an idea for something that I want to build out in the podcasting space. And it's not necessarily exactly what you're building, but I think that the software that you have in place and the few customers that you have in place, I could take and use that as our foundation to build where we're headed. Because it did. It saved me 6 to 9 months. And Simplecast was a great name. And it had some customers using it and they were paying for it. And so it was just this ongoing conversation with Josh and I of, you know, what's good for Josh personally? What's good for Brad personally? What is good for the future of Simplecast? And I really told Josh, like, I want to make this not a hobby project, but I want to use this as the foundation for the company that I want to build for podcasting.
So you just mentioned a couple minutes ago how you had sort of sworn off SaaS and software after your experience with Verb. I mean, how did, like, you change, come back around to, was it just the sort of the possibilities that you saw in podcasting that really got you excited about software space again?
It was the possibilities. It was also the sheer, like, what was I thinking in swearing it off?
Right.
Because, I mean, product and solving problems with consumers on the web is really all I've ever done in my career. And then to be like, well, I'm going to run an incubator and help content brands really build a business. Sure, I could help them build a business, but now how are we going to build them a platform to deliver their podcasts, or how are we going to build them a platform to deliver, you know, long form editorial content? So it was a little bit of just realizing we needed to be in that space, and more of me realizing I never should have gotten out of it to begin with.
Yeah. So you've done a ton of stuff over the past 10, 15 years. What for you, like, where does the drive to sort of constantly create all these things come from? Like, you know, you've got, there's a dozen different things that you've done, at least on a high level. Where does that come from?
I wish I could tell you, Josh. I truly don't know what it is, because every time I have the opportunity to exit an idea or exit a company or start something new, I always say, like, this is the last time, and it's never been the last time. I think the biggest thing for me is it's not just work. Like, I get to wake up every day and I get to create my job. And some days it's really shitty and you make mistakes and companies fail. But then on those days where you win, you get to be like, I and a team that I've built, we accomplish this together. And then there's something very addictive in that whole process that is exciting. And just going back to the days of Nubix, like, I am not cut from a cloth of, you know, wanting to just go in and pour my day into, you know, helping somebody else make money or helping another product grow. And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with that, because there's not. You know, I think I would be in a very different place in my life financially and, you know, potentially with a partner and she and I having kids. Like, there's, I feel I've sacrificed a lot of things to kind of follow what I consider my hobby, which is, you know, building companies and trying to be successful with them. And I love building teams. There's nothing better than the feeling of pulling a group of random people together and then looking back in a year, two, 3 years and go like, wow, like we really were something, not just in the product we built, but in kind of the people that we were and how we worked together. There's a drug in there and I haven't figured out what it is, but yeah.
Yeah, I joke that I would make a really terrible employee. I mean, like, I just could never work for someone. I think I have too strong of a drive to like make stuff. So you've obviously got some business sense, but you've also got a strong design sense as well. Whether you consider yourself a designer or not, I mean, like, which side do you feel like you err more towards? Like, does the business come out of design first, or is it the other way around?
It's a little of both. I am not a designer at all. You can ask anybody that's been a creative director under me ever before, like the new Simplecast player that you see, our embeddable beta player that you use. Like, that was my first time opening a design app in almost 15 years. And
wow.
And I was pretty pleased with it. But at the end of the day, like, I am not a designer, but I do, for some weird reason, not being formally trained, I do have a vision for what I believe is good design. And some of my most successful relationships with previous designers and creative directors are the people that have been willing to work with me on that. And I've always been very lucky to have lead designers, head of design, creative directors that have always been open to me being very vocal when it comes to design. You know, when it comes to like the engineering team and Simplecast, I want to know what's happening. I want to know how we're going to do it. But then I go like, well, you guys are the pros here. I am not. I don't understand half the words you just said. So just go build what you said. And I know it's going to be great. Design is something that I can't do that with. I am too close to it, because I believe that not just with how software works, but the interaction and the interface that a human being has with it has a huge part to do with its success. And that goes back to the early days of the Verb website builder. We didn't have the most robust, best tools out there for building a website. But what we did is we made it very attractive. And in that beauty of the design that we had, we made it very easy and intuitive for a user to stumble into and then quickly figure out. And that is only done through design.
Yep. So what's the next year look like for you and for Simplecast?
Yeah. So we just closed a investment round on the last day of the business year in 2017. So the team is growing very quickly. And really the next 6 months for us is getting a completely envisioned platform out the door, basically rethinking the hosting and analytics, the utility portion of our company. Right now, Simplecast is very much a MVP product. It's a utility, meaning if you're not a podcaster, you don't need our product. Where we go after that is a much broader vision. We need this new platform. We need this new infrastructure to launch in a couple of months. And then we've been doing a year's worth of work and planning and thinking about, where does podcasting need to be in 3 years? Why is it still held back by the constraints of RSS? Like, there's a ton of lists of why can't I when you're looking at podcasts. And it's things that has been solved in every other industry. Like, why can't I publish a blog? Well, guess what? You can now go to Medium and sign up and have a beautiful website for your long form content. You know, why can't I easily publish video to the web and have people watch it and make money off of it? You can now, and it's called YouTube. Podcasting is what I feel when it comes to media on the web, at least media that exists today, not getting into the future of, you know, VR and AR and everything, but media as it exists today, podcasting to me is still a little bit of the Wild West. And that is why I am so extremely excited about it. I am on a level of excitement higher than I ever was before with Verb, because right now it's scary, it's big, it's a booming industry. There's a lot of competitors popping up, but I think the key to where what we're doing and where we're headed is we aren't just trying to compete. We're actually trying to lay a foundation of what we think is going to be the platform that carries podcasting into the future.
Man, I'm pumped just like listening to you talk about it. So that's good stuff, man. Okay, I've taken up a full hour of your time now. So I'm gonna have to wrap it up. I'm gonna like talk to you about podcasting.
You can have as many hours as you want. I'm more worried about the poor individuals that have to listen to me talk for an hour.
No, man, it's good stuff. It's good stuff. Well, so to wrap it up, how can people get in touch with you after they listen?
Well, via the internet and these things called social networks, Twitter @Brad, also Instagram @Brad. Email is brad@simplecast.com. Let's see, what else we got there? DMs on any platform whatsoever. You know what really bugs me, though, is when people have your phone number and your email address, and then you get a random DM from them on Instagram.
So there's so much better ways to get in touch than like, the phone.
Yeah, I don't know if they're just in Instagram and they're like, oh, hey, I want to see what Brad's up to this weekend. And I get a random DM that has nothing to do with the Instagram platform at all. I truly don't understand that. That being said, anyone, everyone, feel free to reach out. Email, social media. I think the kids say that the DMs are open. Is that what you say on Twitter?
I have never said that, but I have been told that.
Okay, in that case, the DMs are open. How about that?
There we go. That's perfect. Well, thanks a ton, Brad. I appreciate you.
Of course. Thanks for this opportunity.
All right, Brad Smith of Verb and Simplecast. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out baremetrics.com. If you have any feedback, I'd love to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@baremetrics.com, or on Twitter @Spigford. Head to founderchats.com to listen to lots of other conversations with startup founders. And if you enjoyed this episode, a rating on iTunes and sharing it with your friends goes a really long way. Thanks again, and see you next week.